Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. There is a lot to get into today, and we will be going through all of it. We're going to start in just a moment with Patrick Hedger and the minimum wage, and I've got a whole nother take on that that I'll share with you after Patrick and I talk. The fate and future of American democracy hanging on the minimum wage. But to kick this thing off, Patrick Hedger is the Vice President of Policy at the Taxpayers Protection Alliance, a conservative think tank. Prior to this, Patrick was with the Competitive Enterprise Institute's Center for Technology and Innovation and worked at FreedomWorks, the right-wing group started by the Koch Network back in the day, who brought us all those protests against Obamacare. ProtectingTaxpayers.org is the website. And Pat Hedger 18 is Patrick's Twitter handle. Patrick, it's been a long time since we've talked. I'm glad to have you back on the program. It seems to me that the real complaint here that we're getting from giant corporations and even the Congressional Budget Office, which goes out of their way to point out how raising the minimum wage will decrease the rate at which wealth is being transferred from working people up to the top 1%. In other words, it will benefit working people. The real complaint is that these big companies that are paying crap wages are being subsidized with our tax dollars through Medicaid, food stamps, and housing support, and they don't want to lose that subsidy. What say you?
Yeah, well, hey, Tom, it's good to see you. It's been too long, and I appreciate you having me back on. So what I would say is, one, we're talking about lots of different types of businesses, right? And we're talking about a one-size-fits-all policy. So we're not just talking about the minimum wage as applied to the mega corporations. We're talking about the minimum wage as also applied to the mom-and-pop shops. And what I would say is that what we see the companies that are lobbying for an increase in the minimum wage, they're actually some of the largest retailers and employers in the country. You have Amazon and Walmart and Costco that are already raising their wages to those levels, or at least advocating for a raise in the minimum wage to those levels. And so I worry that their benevolence on that issue, if you will, is also, there's a little bit of cronyism there where they say, hey, look, we can afford to pay these wages and we know our competitors can't. So I get concerned about that, because ultimately, when you start treating wages the same way that you treat cigarettes or want to treat carbon by increasing the price of low wages, you're going to get less people consuming low-wage workers. And by that, I mean fewer people hiring them or reducing their benefits on the fringe by reducing health care benefits or reducing sick leave benefits, but increasing that wage for the people that are able to keep their jobs. So this money is coming from somewhere, and I worry that the people that we're trying to help by increasing the national minimum wage would disproportionately be harmed by it.
So in other words, you want to maintain these subsidies. You want to maintain a situation where you and I, through our tax dollars, are subsidizing, in your mind, small employers who can't be bothered to put together a business plan where they can actually pay a reasonable wage. You're okay with leaving some 30 million Americans working full time and living in poverty. That's fine with you. And it just seems to me fundamentally immoral, even, to say that we're going to, as a nation, support people whose business model is to exploit workers. I don't get how you could possibly support that, Patrick.
Well, because the true minimum wage is always zero, and I'd rather, you know, put people in a position where they can actually command some sort of wage and then gain the knowledge and skills required to be able to command higher wages later on.
Yeah, we heard that during the Reagan era. You know, that this highfalutin language, you know, the reality is that if the real minimum wage is not zero, there are only two states, Louisiana and Alabama, that have no minimum wage, although the minimum wage is around $5 in some states. But when you look at blue states that already have minimum wages of $12 to $15, they're prosperous. And beyond that, I would ask you to name one single year. The minimum wage has been raised somewhere in the neighborhood of between 25 and 30 times. I'd have to go track down the exact number since it was passed in 1935. And every single time, Republicans, billionaires, and corporations have yelled and screamed about, oh my God, the sky is falling. We're going to have to start laying people off. We're going to lose jobs. And it has never happened. No conservative can point to even one single year where when the minimum wage went up, and there have been minimum wage increases that have exceeded 30% on several occasions, where when the minimum wage went up over the next 3 years, you saw an actual decline in employment. It literally has never happened. Otherwise, every Republican in America would be saying, 1973, you don't want to repeat what happened in 1973. My God, it would be a disaster.
Well, so the two responses to that. So in certain situations and when states raise their minimum wages, you may have a catch-up effect, right, where the natural wage level is already at a level that's beyond where the minimum wage is being raised to. And that in and of itself kind of proves the lack of a need of this policy, where you have natural prices that are already raising people to what people are now considering a livable wage or the minimum acceptable wage. So there's that. So you have a bit of a catch-up effect where you kind of get away with raising the minimum wage without the major side effects that we'd expect. But, you know, just the economic logic tells us that when you raise the price of something, people are going to consume less of it, right? I mean, I would assume, I don't know, I haven't watched your show in a while, but I would assume you're probably in favor of a price on carbon. Why? Because you want people to produce less carbon. Right?
Carbon is not
so
people.
But it is a byproduct.
We're talking people here, Patrick. We're talking human beings. We're talking people who have to go home and face their kids every week and say, I'm sorry, there's not going to be enough food on Friday.
Man, I'm just as concerned about them as you are. I'm just concerned that when you raise the wage level to their employer,
then
they lose their job. I mean, that's what I mean by the true minimum wage being zero, is when people, there's an employment displacement. And when
if an employer cannot afford to pay, if an employer has put together, small or large, has put together a business plan for their business where they can't afford to pay minimum wage people, then they have a flawed business model. It's just
that
simple.
So again, what you're advocating there is $0 wages for the job.
No, I believe in the marketplace. What I'm saying, Patrick, is if somebody goes out of business because they can't afford to pay their workers, there's 100 entrepreneurs behind them who will come into that same marketplace and provide that same good or service and pay a minimum wage. People can figure this out. Entrepreneurs are smart people. They're not idiots. That's why, again, in 100 years, raising the minimum wage has never caused a loss of employment.
I just don't see that as the case. I mean, we saw numerous studies that happened in Washington State where jobs were, when they raised the minimum wage in Seattle, you had people that were taking on employment outside of the city limits that traditionally lived in Seattle because they couldn't find the hours or the benefits that they needed to sustain themselves, even though
prosperity increased.
Right, but
and along with that, prosperity was more demand for goods and services and more economic activity. The more money you can inject at the bottom, Patrick, you know this. Come on, you have an economics background. The more money you can inject at the bottom, the more you're going to stimulate the economy.
Well, again, you're talking about it's not injecting more money. I mean, business owners aren't exactly lining their pockets right now. We're talking about an economy where we've just injected hundreds of billions of dollars out of thin air from the federal government into small businesses to keep their doors open or keep their doors shut, if you will. So I just don't know where you think this is coming from.
All righty. I'll leave you with the last word. Patrick Hedger, Vice President of Policy at the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. The website is protectingtaxpayers.org. You can tweet Patrick at Pat Hedger, H-E-D-G-E-R, 1-8, Pat Hedger, 18. Patrick, thanks for dropping by. It's always good talking with you.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
Morris in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, thanks for listening to KPFK. What's on your mind?
Good morning to you. Good morning to you, Professor. Look here, in church they got this song that says, sweep around your own front door before you try to sweep around mine. And that's what we're going to do this morning.
I like that.
We're going to sweep around the front door of Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the chairperson of the budget committee. Everybody knows that. We're going to hashtag, don't kill it, Bernie. Hashtag, don't kill it, Bernie refers to that $15 minimum wage per hour, $15, which would put $90+ billion. In circulation forever. Now, this 1.9 COVID thing, that's a one-shot thing, stimulus thing, and that's a good thing. We need it right now. But $15 lasts forever, okay? This parliamentarian stuff, the corporate Democrats, which includes our president, are trying to hang their hat on, So Bernie's got to keep that in it. If we're going to go down, let's go down with our principles, because if we can't win this right here, we will have trouble in 2022 and 24, because we haven't kept no promises. But more so than that, Professor, we ain't showing no spine to get out there and fight. We're in a dogfight, okay? And Joe Manchin threatening to do this and threatening to do that. Let them people of West Virginia find out that Joe Manchin was the reason they not getting $15 an hour or any COVID benefits, okay? The Chamber of Commerce is behind all of this. They like water. You know, water can be salt or fresh. So they're financing both sides. But we as progressives, we got to stand up and say, the Republicans got a battle going on. We got one going on with our corporate people and our progressives. So hashtag don't kill it, Bernie. Keep the $15 in there. He's chairperson of the budget committee for a reason. Look here, if your rent was due on the 1st of April and you had $1,000 and you can go to Vegas with that $1,000 and put a bet that would bring you $3,000 that Bernie would keep this in or take it out, you bet he'd keep it in. Am I right or wrong?
I think you're right, but I don't think that Bernie is the guy. I get your point, you know, if it's going to get out of committee and all that kind of stuff. But it's coming across to the House as a privileged motion. I mean, in theory, Chuck Schumer could simply bring it directly to the floor because it came right out of the House. So it doesn't even need to go through committee. But that would require Kamala Harris. And so
Bingo. What
I'm thinking, Morris, is that the hashtag should be hashtag something like Harris: fire the parliamentarian, or Harris, ignore the parliamentarian, or, you know, Harris, do what Republicans have done in the past and fire. I realize that's too long for a hashtag.
Like,
you get what I'm saying?
That's pretty good. Yeah, brother, I like that. Okay, well, you go on, Tom. I had a chance to do my little rant. I'll give it to you later on.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Morris. Good talking with you. Appreciate the call. Dennis in Riverside, California. Hey, Dennis, what's up?
Hey, what's up? Listen, the minimum wage thing. I saw this for years. Whenever they have the argument about it, say minimum wage is suppressed for, say, 13 or 14 years. And meanwhile, prices rise, right?
Yeah.
And then when they say, let's raise it because you got to work an hour to buy a price of a hamburger meal. Somebody says, no, that's the cause of rising prices, raising minimum wage. Well, what causes it in that 13 or 14 year interval? Magic?
Exactly. Exactly. No, labor costs are typically, there are a few exceptions to this, but broadly speaking, labor costs are a very small part of the cost of running a business. And, you know, most businesses can absorb moderate increases in labor costs, like at the bottom end, very simply, by simply reducing slightly their profits. Dennis, thank you for the call. So let me take this even a step beyond where I started. Okay, raising the minimum wage is the moral thing. It's the easy thing, easy in terms of business. I mean, as I said to Patrick, you know, if a business can't afford, in quotes, to raise the minimum wage, let them go out of business. They will be replaced by another business that knows how to do it. It's just that simple. This is how it has been since the beginning of our republic. This is how it is in every other developed country in the world that has a minimum wage higher than the United States, which is the vast majority of them. I think it might be all of them, all of the 34 OECD countries, but I don't have the numbers right in front of me, so I can't absolutely confirm that. But I guarantee you, it's the vast majority if it's not all of them. So all that's true. But the reason why I think raising the minimum wage right now is an existential crisis for our nation, for democracy itself, is because the big battle right now is not between Democratic ideas about how the economy should work and Republican ideas about how the economy should work. It's not the debate that Patrick and I just had, which is kind of the old-fashioned left versus right debate. The real fight that's going on right now is between a Democratic Party that believes in governance, that believes that government can do things to make the lives of people better, that government can provide a floor through which people don't fall, that government can provide those basic functions that the framers and the founders of this country and the framers of the Constitution laid out in the preamble to the Constitution, where they said that the general welfare was one of, and domestic tranquility, what Jefferson referred to as happiness in the Declaration of Independence, that domestic tranquility and the general welfare were the reasons why they were creating the Constitution and why America was reinventing itself after the Articles of Confederation into a democratic republic. That republic itself, the United States of America as a democratic republic, small d, cap, small r, the United States of America as a democracy is actually what's at stake in this debate around the minimum wage. Now, let me explain. Obviously, you know, 30 million people working full time and yet living in poverty is not a crisis that is going to end democracy. It's a crisis. It's a moral crisis. It's a terrible failing here in the United States, but it's not going to end democracy. Those people are not going to rise up and overthrow the government. Frankly, most of them are too poor to be able to even, you know, engage in such a thing. They can't afford a $5,000 military style, assault weapon. No, the real danger to democracy comes when people like that and the middle class in general, what's left of it. Keep in mind, after 30 years of Reaganomics, 10 years ago, more than half of Americans ceased to be in the middle class, which means that we have to recalibrate the middle class because the middle isn't where the middle used to be. But the real danger to democracy is that larger spectrum of people, that bottom 70% of Americans, basically, who are earning under $40,000 a year individually. The median individual income in the United States right now is $30,000 a year, $15 an hour. That's the median income, individual income. The median household income is around between $48,000 and $50,000, depending on whose numbers you're looking at. But that's because two people are working. In fact, the average household has 2.3 people working in it. Unlike 50 years ago when it was 1.2 people. So the crisis is that those people are going to say, government can't do a damn thing for anybody. The Democrats can't even pass stuff. They can't even get the damn minimum wage passed. Screw the Democrats. They're ineffectual. They're incapable. I'm going to go with that strongman guy, Donald Trump, or his heir, his Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton, Rick Scott heir, who claims that he's going to help me. He's going to help the middle class. And I don't care if he turns this country into a fascist, you know, neoliberal paradise. I don't care what else they do. I just want somebody to do something. I mean, this was the dynamic that played out in 2016. Donald Trump promised to raise taxes on rich people. He promised to raise wages on working people. He promised to give everybody a national health care system. He promised to cut student debt. He promised to bring jobs back from overseas. Those are all Bernie's positions. But they were in the mouth of a Republican, and they were credible, and Hillary Clinton was saying, well, I don't know that we can do all those things. And here we are. And as long as Democrats can't do all those things, because they're kowtowing to the Senate parliamentarian or to the Republicans, democracy itself is at risk. This is not just about the minimum wage. This is about the survival of America as a republic.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And Kamala Harris needs to have the strength to do what Republicans have done in the past and fire the parliamentarian and replace her with somebody who will give us the information we need.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Book Club. Today we're reading from Hannah Arendt's book, The Origins of Totalitarianism. And I've known about this book, read little pieces of it for decades. I mean, it's the classic work on totalitarianism. It's long and there's a lot of words in it. But for this moment, Elliot Lustig was tweeting about Donald Trump. This is back when Donald Trump was talking about 3 to 5 million illegal immigrants voting, right? And he said, Hannah Arendt, in her book, The Origin of Totalitarianism, provides a helpful guide for interpreting the language of fascists. She noted how decent liberals of 1930s Germany would fact-check the Nazis' bizarre claims about things like Jews as if they were meant to be factual. What they failed to understand, Arendt suggests, is that the Nazi Jew-hating was not a statement of fact, but a declaration of intent. So when someone would blame the Jews for Germany's defeat in World War I, naive people would counter by saying, there's no evidence of that. What the Nazis were doing was not describing what was true, but what would have to be true in order to justify what they planned to do next. So did 3 million illegals cast vote in the election? Clearly not. But fact-checking is just a way of playing along with their game. What Trump is saying is not that 3 million illegals voted. What he's saying is, I'm going to steal the voting rights of millions of Americans. So that's kind of a contemporary frame for this book. So let's read from the book itself. Here, this is from page 348. And she's talking about totalitarian movements and how they use propaganda, how they communicate with the public, and the difference between terror and propaganda, the kind of terror that they can inculcate by just kind of randomly arresting people. Pretty much everybody's committed some kind of crime at some point, right? Arresting people, and on the one hand, that's the terror, or convincing the people. She says, totalitarian movements use socialism and racism by emptying them of their utilitarian content, the interests of a class or a nation. The form of infallible protection in which these concepts were presented has become more important than their content. The chief qualification of a mass leader has become unending infallibility. He can never admit an error. The assumption of infallibility, moreover, is based not so much on superior intelligence as on the correct interpretation of the essentially reliable forces in history and nature, forces which neither defeat nor ruin can prove wrong because they're bound to assert themselves in the long run. Mass leaders in power have one concern which overrides all utilitarian consideration, to make their predictions come true. The Nazis did not hesitate to use, at the end of the war, the concentrated force of their still intact organization to bring about as complete a destruction of Germany as possible.
in order to make true their prediction that the German people would be ruined in case of defeat. The propaganda effect of infallibility, the striking success of posing as a mere interpreting agent of predictable forces, has encouraged in totalitarian dictators the habit of announcing their political intentions in the form of prophecy. The most famous example is Hitler's announcement to the German Reichstag in January 1939, quote, "I want today once again to make a prophecy. In case the Jewish financiers succeed one more in hurling the people into a world war, the result will be the annihilation of the Jewish race in Europe," end of quote. Translated into non-totalitarian language, this means, "I intend to make war and I intend to kill the Jews of Europe." Similarly, Stalin, in the great speech before the Central Committee of the Communist Party in 1930, in which he prepared the physical liquidation of intra-party right and left deviationists, described them as representatives of dying classes. This definition not only gave the argument its specific sharpness, but also announced in totalitarian style the physical destruction of those whose dying out had just been prophesied. In both instances, the same objective is accomplished. The liquidation is fitted into a historical process in which man not only suffers or does or suffers what, according to some immutable law, is bound to happen anyway. As soon as the execution of the victims has been carried out, the prophecy becomes a retrospective alibi. Nothing happened but what has already been predicted. It does not matter whether the laws of history spell the doom of the classes and their representatives, or whether the laws of nature exterminate all those elements, democracies, Jews, Eastern subhumans, the Untermenschen, or the incurably sick. They are not fit to live anyway. Incidentally, Hitler, too, spoke of dying classes that ought to be, quote, "eliminated without much ado," end quote. This method, like other totalitarian propaganda methods, is foolproof only after the movements have seized power. Then all debate about the truth or falsity of a totalitarian dictator's prediction is as weird as arguing with a potential murderer about whether his future victim is dead or alive, since by killing the person in question, the murderer can provide prompt proof of the correctness of his statement. The only valid argument under such conditions is promptly to rescue the person whose death has been predicted. Before mass leaders seize the power to fit reality to their lies, their propaganda is marked by its extreme contempt for facts as such, for in their opinion, fact depends entirely on the power of the man who can fabricate it. The assertion that the Moscow subway is the only one in the world is a lie only so long as the Bolsheviks have not the power to destroy all the others. From Hannah Arendt's book, The Origins of Totalitarianism.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Let's pick up your phone calls here. Michelle in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Michelle, what's on your mind?
I want to give a perspective on the minimum wage from an employer's perspective. My husband is an executive chef. Thank God his restaurant is still open. The owners of the restaurant want the minimum wage to be up to $15 an hour because they pay on average $18 an hour for their employees. And another friend of mine owns another restaurant, and he does the same thing. So if the floor is raised, then wages will be raised for everyone, not just, but they're tired of hearing people whine about not being able to make it on $7.25 an hour when they're paying $18 an hour. I mean, they're squeaking by during this pandemic, but they're squeaking by. And they want everybody else's wages to come up so they're not the ones having to do other things. That's all I got to say.
Well, not only
have a good day. Oh, go ahead.
Not only that, Michelle, if in Kansas City, Missouri, the wages go up to $15 an hour, your husband's restaurant's going to have more customers coming in, able to afford, you know, a monthly meal there.
Exactly. And if you can't take care of your employees, how are you going to take care of anybody else?
There you go.
Thank you, Tom. Have a good
Michelle.
Day.
Thank you. You too. Julia in Redding, California, you want to take a contrarian position on this?
I just wanted to point out, I've been hearing arguments, especially from the corporate Democrat side, that raising the minimum wage would reduce the job market. And I said, yeah, I agree. The father that's working three jobs to support his family will only have to work two.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Brilliant. Or the person who's working two jobs will only have to work one. You know, $2, $7.25 an hour jobs they can replace, you know, and working 80 hours a week, they can now work 40 hours a week and have time with their kids and their families. Julia, I thought you were going in a completely different direction, but brilliant. Thank you so much for that. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Oh, I appreciate listening to you.
Oh, thank you, Julia. Thank you for your kind words. Patrick in East Lansing, Michigan. Patrick, what's up?
Thank you, Tom. This is a great discussion. I had 2 points. I was listening to the One Fair Wage press conference after spending a weekend talking to various groups about this issue, and I learned that any senator can ask to have the parliamentarian's ruling overruled. And I thought that if we lobbied our senators, even ones who support this, we could ask them to do that. And if Vice President Harris overruled the parliamentarian, it takes 60 votes to overrule her. So,
that's correct.
You know, if they're going to make these arguments, what you're saying today on the show is exactly where we need to go. Because if it fails to have a mandate, to have a minimum wage, Bernie Sanders wants to do what Eric Levitt said in New York Magazine, which is just to put in a tax measure like the Republicans did when they tried to repeal the individual mandate and make businesses that hire people and don't pay the $15 minimum wage become ineligible for tax credits and federal funds. And I would urge anyone to read this New York Magazine article. It's very good on that procedural question.
Yeah.
The other article that's so good on it is Michael Reich at Morning Consult, because he puts a number on how much we are paying. He says raising the $15 minimum wage will save the federal budget $65 billion, and that's because we get $21 billion more in income tax revenues and payroll taxes, but then we save $32 billion on all these programs, food stamps and other programs. So if companies have to pay the price of losing their tax credits, then we can claw back this money that we're giving them. And the only last thing I'll say is the job effects are just not there, the lost jobs. And Dale Bellman did a wonderful book, What Does the Minimum Wage Do? And good summaries of his book are online in articles. He worked at Economic Policy Institute. He surveyed 70 studies. He found statistically insignificant evidence of any job loss, which just straight down the line hammers your point home. And I couldn't agree with you more, and I thank you for what you're doing.
Yeah. Patrick, I would add that the two strategies that you described, the strategy of Kamala Harris saying, we're simply going to ignore the parliamentarian, as Republicans have done in the past, and we're going to push this through. That strategy and the Plan B strategy that Bernie has talked about of putting immediately into law a federal law that says any company that doesn't pay $15 an hour isn't eligible for all the goodies you get from the federal government are not mutually exclusive, because this minimum wage, this $15 minimum wage, phases in over 5 years. And Bernie's plan to attack companies, essentially, you know, take away their federal goodies for not paying $15 an hour could take effect immediately. So you could do both. And thank you very much for bringing it up, Patrick. It's great to hear from you. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Oh, you know, Tom, this subject is really so close to my heart because your guest just told every old lie in the book, and starting with that the minimum wage is really zero. And as the last caller pointed out, you don't have the job losses because of it, because presumably, as you know, Tom, as an employer, you're not hiring more people than you need, right? You don't have people sitting around doing not doing anything that if I had to pay, you know, Joyce and Sean and so-and-so more, I'd get rid of you because Paul, because presumably you wouldn't hire me to sit and do nothing. You're hiring the people that you need.
Correct.
And so you're
well, let me add
right.
to that, Paul, if I could, just very briefly. There was a time in America when the minimum wage was zero. And we called those minimum wage workers who earned zero slaves.
And, that's right.
You know, so if the Republicans really want to make that pitch, good luck.
No, that is the pitch that the Confederate Party is making, Tom. They are still the party of slavery. And, you know, you get this, you know, first of all, these are not job creators. They're time wasters. And I call them time wasters. I love Julia, the woman from California, her saying, I might not have to work three jobs, I will only have to work two. What a clever, I just love that. These employers are time wasters. And it goes back to this. If my daily bread costs a dollar and I make 99 cents, I still can't buy my daily bread. You've wasted my whole damn day. And I still don't get my daily bread. And I sure as hell can't afford to pay taxes. So by low wages, this is how they convince the Trump, you know, the people who don't make it, that the taxes should be low because, look, you're making so little, you couldn't afford to pay any taxes. So they put the person in the same mind frame as the rich who say, I don't want to pay any taxes. And so it really is just a big lie. But you know what? Here's the foil they always use. And a local talk show host here in Seattle, and you know the one down who talks down near you, I won't mention his name, says, well, why wouldn't it 15, why not 30 or 45 or $50 an hour if that's so great
that's
for
stupid society?
And I'm asked the question, okay, well, let's take it your way. If you don't want to double it or triple it, if that's not good, how about we cut it in half? Why don't we make it 350 or 240 or $1.80 an hour? Wouldn't that be better for society? Couldn't employers hire more people, which they wouldn't because they don't need them? But you know what they say? If that's what they're willing to work for, and Tom, that is exactly the wording that was in Lochner, that if two people want to agree to have you work for, you know, 2 cents an hour, that you should be able to do that. In fact, in Lochner, the argument was that a baker should have to, a baker should have to work in the basement of a building where the ceiling is only 4.5 feet tall in temperatures of baking ovens and work there 20 hours a day. And the state of New York had no right to say anything about the contract between that employer and the baker, that you should be able to tell them to do anything you want. And here's another thing, Tom, I'm on my rant here. If they find that an employer has more than 40 work hours per person and they're splitting it up to part-time help, I think you should have to pay $17.25 an hour. Because where else can you buy things for less? You know, whenever you buy it in lesser amounts, you end up paying more, right? When you buy the economy size, you get it for less. But if you buy things in a small package, except when it comes to buying help, when it comes to buying labor, no, they can do it, and they cut your hours. If you could hire for 40 hours a week and you're only giving somebody 25 or 20 hours a week, I think you should have to pay $17.25 an hour, 15% more, just like you do when you buy a small amount of a product. See, they never like to obey the economic rules that they put down or the laws they say they don't want to buy it for. And here's another thing about restaurants. The price of food has gone up 10 times. Since 1968, it's 10 times more, at least 10 times more. And I remember looking up the price of ground beef in 1968 was 39 cents a pound. And you can't touch it for $3.90. Now you can't touch it for practically under $6 a pound. And so you ever hear restaurants complaining about, oh, we just couldn't pay the price of food, right? When the price of food goes up, they say we have to just raise our rates. But when it comes to labor, they don't feel that way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Paul, thank you for the call. Paul does great rants. It's the Tom Hartman Program, the place where despair is not an option.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Chris in Humphrey, Arkansas, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, I pay $20 an hour. I'm disabled, and my sole source of income for my company is my Social Security check. And, yeah, I'm trying to get PPP, and I am worried about my my student loan. I have gotten my student loan forgiven because of my disability. But I look at my credit report, and there is still a charge off for like $30,000 on there from my student loan, and I can't get rid of it.
Are you saying that you are running a one-man small business, Chris?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. I get it. Thank you. Scotty in Seattle. Hey, Scotty, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I was just thinking that I'm tying this $15 minimum wage to what I think is the collapse of democracy. If the Republicans are deliberately trying to keep people in poverty, that is...
And they are.
Similar to the insurrection, and they're trying... I call it the collapse of democracy. And where is this leading to, the new dark ages?
Well, what it's leading to is Donald Trump's strongman fascist rule. You've got now several serious candidates. Rick Scott, Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton are at the front of the pack. Kristi Noem, I think, is more of a flash in the pan. I think that Ted Cruz is just too smarmy. Nobody's ever going to really vote for him. But these three white men, I think, and Nikki Haley, I think, has counted herself out by criticizing Donald Trump. I think she's really hurt her chances of running in 2024. So you've got, in particular, these three white guys who are all in on Trumpism, are sucking up to Donald Trump, would have the support of Donald Trump when they run. And if one of them becomes president running against Kamala Harris, which is going to be a bit more of a lift because she's a black woman, on the at least in terms of the white racist vote, which will show up against her. On the other hand, it might further animate the black vote as Barack Obama's presidency did. So, you know, it might balance out. Who knows? But if one of those three guys becomes president in 2024, you can kiss America goodbye, because 4 years later, this country will not resemble anything we have ever seen in this country before, or anything that we've ever seen in Canada before, in North America, essentially. What you will see is the United States becoming Hungary.
I don't think they're qualified to govern even under any circumstances. What the hell are we going to do with the country when they're the president of what? No democracy. How's that going to work?
Well, it'll work the way it does in Russia right now.
No, terrific.
You turn it into an oligarchy. You get the big right-wing billionaire donors who put Donald Trump into office, who put Ronald Reagan into office, who put both George Bushes into office, and who own every single Republican senator, and I think all but maybe a half a dozen of the Democratic members of the House, or the Republican members of the House of Representatives. You will have those oligarchs pulling the strings, and they will get richer and continue to get richer and richer and richer, just like the oligarchs in the former Soviet states do, and in Russia.
So we get more.
And you're going to have a strong man who's going to declare himself. Trump has already said he's going to declare himself president for life. He will do it. And if he doesn't do it, Tom Cotton will do it. I mean, that's, if you want to see what it's going to look like, it's not a mystery. Look at Duterte in the Philippines. He's doing it right now. Look at Modi in India. He's preparing to do it. This is happening around the world.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Andy in Hoosick Falls, New York. Hey, Andy, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to give you a little story. I worked as a retail store manager for about a dozen years. They're always small businesses, 3 to 4 employees. We always paid about $3 an hour more on average than, say, the big box stores, retailers. And the big reason for it was loss prevention. We we found that paying about $50 to $60 a day more for, say, two good quality employees saved us in product walking out of the store, either externally or internally. They were more in tune with keeping theft from walking out the store and internal theft, people who got resentful about their low-wage jobs, they would steal. And then the result was higher turnover, more costs to retrain, higher insurance costs. So my argument would always be that a $15 minimum wage is an actual cost savings.
And it the is. Reason, it actually yeah, is. I mean, and when you consider the cost to retrain, to train a new worker, that's substantial. I mean, the president of Costco, when he was testifying before Congress last week, pointed out that one of the reasons that, you know, I mean, they're paying above the minimum wage and they pay benefits. And he said, you know, one of the reasons for this is that we have, you know, good employee retention. It costs money to train. It costs money to hire people. It costs money to vet them. It costs money to train them. And when they leave, it costs money to find the new replacement. All those are real costs.
Right. And so the argument I've always seen, this is a lobbying argument, because for a small business owner to pay maybe two or three people an extra $3 an hour is only going to cost them $50. But when you're talking major retailers with 10,000 employees, $3 an hour becomes a huge payroll problem to them. So this argument against the minimum wage is a lobbying effort from very large corporations who don't want to pay and raise their bottom line. Small business owners are perfectly willing to do it because they see the savings. They see it right away in loss prevention.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. Andy, thank you for the call. Ramesu in Birmingham, Alabama. Am I saying your name right?
Yes, you are.
You're on the air.
I'm such a fan of your show. The issue, I think, when it comes to raising minimum wage and just improving the overall financial health of the average working class person, a large portion of this country votes against their own best interests, especially in this Bible Belt region. I mean, they vote against, you know, increasing the minimum wage. They vote against unionizing. That and the fact that so many counties...
Ramesu, do you think that that's because it's more important to them to stop abortions than it is to have a decent paycheck?
Well, the right wing, the Republican Party, they use... no abortion, but it's
and guns. It's
guns, and, but ultimately, I think it comes down in part to their whiteness. You know,
yeah.
A lot of people.
You're right.
In this region, are poor. They don't. I mean, the economic boom has really just passed them over. You know, they don't have any. Anything. I mean, kind of like Barack Obama said, only thing they have left are their guns and their God or the Bible. So, you know, they're being so brainwashed and used. I mean, when you vote against your own self-interest, I mean, they refuse to unionize in the South, you know?
Yep. No, I totally get it. I totally get it. And you said it very well. Thank you very much. Mike in Bailey, Colorado. Hey, Mike.
How's it going, Tom? Hey, you know, during all these bailouts that we're doing, the COVID rescues that we're doing, no one's really dealing with the issue about the rent moratorium, because these people are piling up tons of debt. What's happened in New York, I'm surprised, hasn't happened already much sooner. In Albany, a landlord, about 4 days ago, kidnapped his two tenants to evict them, zip-tied their hands, threw a pillowcase over their head, threw them in a van, drove them miles away, and dropped them off in a cemetery. If that's not a warning to these people, I don't know what is. And through all of these COVID rescues, no one outside of, like, Cori Bush, Bernie's mentioned, you know, the back rent piling up. But this is going to really blow up. And when you got BlackRock sitting there just waiting to swoop in on all these foreclosures of rental properties and people's homes, this is going to be devastating to our economy. And now you got a guy who's going a guy who was probably a decent landlord at some time is so frustrated that he is willing to commit felonies that's going to lock him up for years.
No, I get it, Mike. I get it, Mike. And I agree with you. I think just like the student debt thing has created a disaster, this housing thing is going to be even bigger and faster.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
And welcome to the Tom Hartman University Book Club. Today we're reading from Esther Forbes' book, Paul Revere and the World He Lived In. It was actually sent to me in 2010. It's a remarkable book. You'll recall I've talked about how every time our country reboots, it goes through a major transformation. It's the result of, or it follows an economic crash. Every time we do a positive transformation. And, you know, we've talked about the crash of 1837, the crash of 1856, the crash of 1889, the crash of 1929, all of which provoked very positive changes. I suppose you could argue the Civil War wasn't a positive change, but this is what provoked the Revolutionary War. This is from page 98 of Paul Revere and the World He Lived In. January 15, 1765, the trade, Merchant Rowe noted, has been much alarmed this day. Mr. Wheelwright stopped payment and kept his room. A great number of people will suffer by him. Nat Wheelwright was the first of many merchants to collapse that spring. During the war, merchants had increased their stock and speculated. Farmers had enlarged their farm. Those boom years were over. The Depression was begun, and in Boston, it lasted 20 years. January 19th, 1765. Very bad accounts. Dr. John Scholey shut up. Dr. John Denny shut up. And Peter Bourne of the North End. By shut up, they mean close their businesses. Am unlikely to be a large sufferer by Scholey. Now Mr. Rowe is really apprehensive. He is a cautious gentleman, no longer young. Even the walking was dangerous that day. Extreme bad and slippery. This is his diaries she's reading from. Next day was Sabbath. Mr. and Mrs. Rowe never missed services at Trinity, but did not go to church. My mind too much disturbed. Just as he should have been starting, his dear friend Joseph Scott had come up to see him very disturbed. Sure enough, next day, Mr. Scott had also shut down his business, and William Hasking and the company had been shut down as well. A bank failed for 170,000 British pounds. Mr. Savage fell in a fatal apocalyptic fit in his lawyer's office. Captain Forbes shut up his shop today. Am much grieved for him, wrote one of the diaries. The merchants were going down like a house of playing cards. Each big house, such as Mr. Rowe mentions, carried innumerable small ones with it. Shipwrights, sailors, and sailmakers might suffer first, but tailors and perucky makers, button molders or soap boilers, silversmiths or braziers all followed. Rents and mortgages could not be paid. The clergy began to find more copper and less silver in the alms basin. Farmers drove mutton to town, could get no decent price, and angrily drove them home again. Only one-fifth of the usual numbers of ships cleared that water from Boston for the West Indies. Not only was the artificial wartime prosperity over, but the merchants could not pay the duties now demanded of them. They experimented in short runs along the coast or kept their ships laid up as one after another shut down. The stagnation of trade gave everyone, from Mr. Rowe and his fellow merchants like the young Mr. John Hancock, dining as elegantly as ever at the Royal Coffee House, to the meanest porter in the cheapest alehouse, a leisure to talk they had never enjoyed before. Boston went off into a talking jag that did not end until Lexington. That would be the shot heard around the world. Why was there no money to be made on the fine ships, which for 100 years had been bringing wealth to Boston? Why was there no work for a willing, able-bodied man? Who was to blame? England's efforts to enforce her navigation acts had upset long-established trade habits, but she had not as yet actually collected enough money over here to pay her customs officials. It seemed to have been the general opinion from the top of the social ladder to the bottom that England was to blame. The overexpansion of the last 40 years probably had as much to do with it as England, but it was the meddlesome tyrant from overseas that was the scapegoat. King George III was popular. Their enemy was Parliament. Grenville, as Chancellor of the Exchequer, looked about for some other form of taxation that could actually produce the money. Controlling smuggling over so long a coast, 3,000 miles away, was proving expensive, impractical, and extremely unpopular. After talking with the colonial agents in London and asking for alternative suggestions, he put the Stamp Act through Parliament. "I am not, however," he said, "set upon this tax. If the Americans dislike it and prefer any other method, I shall be content, provided the money must be raised." As soon as the Stamp Act went into effect, which it never did, every legal document, every newspaper or commercial paper would need a stamp, costing from a half penny to 20 shillings. It would require very few officers to enforce and no breaking and entering of private property. As Grenville argued, it would fall fairly equally on all colonies and classes. But it was technically an internal tax, not an external like a customs duties, and its theory frightened the colonists. Whether or not England had the legal right to tax these colonies in any way she pleased does not seem to be settled yet. Probably she had, but it was the utmost folly to do so. This distinction, this is a quote, "this distinction between internal and external taxes seems to be the Inquirer today, as it did to so many in that day, almost a quibble. The one should be universally accepted through generations and the other start men to their feet shouting liberty or death has never been satisfactorily explained." Paul Revere and the world he lived in. Lisa in Montreal, Canada. Hey, Lisa, what's up?
Well, I had just wanted to give a little bit of an idea about the way our minimum wages work here, because it's really kind of a progressive way that it goes. So it's $14.25 is the general. That's from the Canadian government, mm-hmm. the federal government.
That's the federal
minimum
wage. And then
the student is, right. Yeah. So the student is $13.40. Those are for students, you know, who work during the summer or, you know, part-time jobs. And liquor servers are $12.45. But for $12.45, the liquor servers, they, all of your tips are tax-free. They go into your pocket. So that's probably
just like
why
they were in the United States before the Reagan administration.
Right. Yeah. So they go into your pocket. They're yours and non-taxable. And Alberta has the highest minimum wage, which is $15. It can sometimes go a little bit higher. It's been as high as about $17. And Ontario is $14.25. Presently now in Quebec, it's $13.50. And we're looking for an increase is September 1st, 2021, which will go up to, I think it's $14.25. BC is $14.60. I didn't really take a look at the eastern states. But, I mean, what I'm trying to say is you can't live off of, I can't imagine $7.25 an hour, even if it's U.S., even when you change your currency balance.
That would be about $9 an hour in Canadian dollars.
And it's just impossible. I work for the federal government. Well, actually, it's the provincial government. I'm in healthcare. I've been working now. I'm in my 36th year. I'm retiring soon. And I'm out now at my top echelon, which I can make between $24 to $28 dollars an hour. My average take-home salary per year would be about $36,000, which is pretty decent. I mean, you can live comfortably. Remember, we have
Lisa.
GST,
I think that particularly when an American audience is hearing this information about how it is in Canada, there's two things that are missing from the equation, and that is, how much does your health care cost you, and how much does education cost you in Canada? Because those are two of the major sources of debt and bankruptcy here in the United States, particularly for people working at minimum wage.
Okay, so healthcare, of course, it costs us, pretty much nothing. I would say, are you talking about per year or?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say when I pay my insurance premiums for a year, I would say it's about $845. But remember, that is including also medication, hospital services, ambulance, and also that amount is taken out of my salary, and it's also tax deductible. So I can also add that to my taxes. So
so you spend $800 a year and you've got comprehensive health insurance. You know, most Americans don't get comprehensive health insurance for $800 a month. Now, if somebody wanted to go to college in Canada and they didn't want to go to, you know, the Canadian equivalent of Harvard, a high-end fancy private university, but instead they wanted to go to like the University of Montreal, what does that cost?
Oh boy, your tuition per semester, not including books, is now presently around $1,800 per semester, and books will add up to maybe another $1,005. So we're talking 3,000 per semester. But you can also apply for student loans and bursaries. It all depends on what the salary of your parents are, or if you're working yourself. There's a lot of incentives to, it really isn't that expensive. If we're not talking about a top line
university. Lisa, thank you. Thank you for sharing your experience and the information with an American audience. I really appreciate it. And greetings to you and all your friends in Montreal. Thank you so much. We'll be back with more of the news and more of my thoughts and yours in this kind of national town hall meeting we have here every day on the Tom Hartman program. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Never was intended to be. It requires you. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.